Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Chronicles. We left off in chapter 10. We're going to be getting into a portion of Chronicles now where this whole kingdom of God's people is going to end up being split. It's going to end up being divided as a judgment from God because of all of Solomon's, his wickedness. He got away from the Lord. Here he was, the wisest man that ever lived, and we see clearly through the scriptures and through extra-biblical reading and through the books of the writings of Josephus that he ended up having 700 wives, 300 concubines, which is the equivalent of 1,000 wives. And a number of these women that he did marry, eventually they turned his heart from the Lord. And I don't know where this guy is tonight. I kind of get the... if I was to put a wager on it, I would say that God was merciful to him at his death, that he probably had a deathbed. I don't want to say a conversion, but he probably, repented of all of his backsliding. Yeah.
When you read Ecclesiastes at the end, you tend to get that feeling or impression.
Well, yeah, because in the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes, he says we need to understand something, that everything's going to be brought into judgment. Okay, that's what he's saying in Ecclesiastes. So I'm not sure exactly when he wrote that Ecclesiastes, but I do know this. He ended up being pretty well shipwrecked, and we're going to be reading about that tonight. But I want to just kind of set this stage here, because I made this list as far as the kings of Judah and Israel, because people could get really confused here. Because actually the very first king was Saul. We know that he ended up totally shipwrecked as far as his relationship with the Lord was concerned. And God just basically turned the kingdom over to David. And then David was a good king. And I've got a list here of all the kings that reigned in Judah. That's the southern tribes. And then because Israel is going to be split now, you got the northern tribes and the southern tribes. So you're going to be going back and forth. We're going to be going back and forth through this Chronicles. The king of Judah or the king of Israel. King of Judah, king of Israel. You just got to substitute king of the south, king of the north. All right. And if you look at up north here, you're going to have 19 different kings in the north. And not one of them was good in God's sight. Not one of them. And then the track record wasn't a whole lot better with the southern tribes, because starting with Saul, he ended up with 23 different kings until the southern kingdom was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and everybody was just hauled off over there to Babylon, the survivors. But out of those 23 in the south, you only had about half a dozen that were good. Mm-hmm. Right, and then you had about two or three, four of them that started out really good, and then they ended up shipwrecked. So I'm just trying to preface this now, because this can get kind of confusing, going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And now we're going to be dealing with Solomon's son. He has a son, and his name is Rehoboam. And then this other king that's going to be the king of the south, his name is Jeroboam. Mm-hmm. And I never can get these names right. So for all you people who are, really good at linguistics, you can crucify me later when I butcher up by these people's name. Because, you got Jeroboam and Rehoboam. I know I'm going to be messing up these guys' names, but just bear with me, okay? But what I want to do is I want to read this entire chapter 10 of 1 Chronicles, just so you get the theme of it. But then we're going to have to go back to fill in all the details as what really is taking place here. Because now Solomon has died, and now his son, Rehoboam, is going to reign in his place. But God is going to judge the kingdom. It's going to split because Solomon ended up shipwrecked as far as God was concerned, and now as a judgment, the nation is going to be divided. All right, so beginning with the first one of chapter 10 of 2 Chronicles, it says, "Then Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all of Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. When Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was in Egypt where he had fled from the presence of King Solomon, Jeroboam returned from Egypt. So they sent and summoned him, and when Jeroboam and all that Israel came, they spoke to Rehoboam, and saying, 'Your father made your yoke hard. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and this heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you.' He said to them, 'Return to me again in 3 days.' So the people departed. Then King Rehoboam consulted with the elders who had served his father Solomon while he was still alive, saying, "How do you counsel me to answer this people?" They spoke to him, saying, "If you will be kind to this people and please them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever." But he forsook the counsel of the elders which they had given him, and he consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. So he said to them, "What counsel do you give that we may answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke which your father put on us'?" The young men who grew up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you shall say to the people who spoke to you, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter for us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Whereas my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions.'" So Jeroboam and all of the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had directed them. "Return to me on the third day." The king answered them harshly, and King Rehoboam forsook the counsel of the elders. He spoke to them according to the advice of the young man, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to it. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from God that the Lord might establish his word, which he spoke to Ahijah the Shilonite, to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. When all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, "What portion do we have with David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to your tents, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David." So all of Israel departed to their tents. But as for the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. Then King Rehoboam sent Hadoram, who was over the forced labor, and the sons of Israel stoned him to death, and King Rehoboam made haste to mount his chariot and to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel had been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Now, what I need to do, I think it's very important in order to just set the groundwork so that people can understand what is happening here, is that the kingdom is now going to be split. But this is what God had predicted, and the way he predicted it is that when Solomon, he got so involved with these other, well, women who were not converted to Judaism. These women turned his heart. As a matter of fact, in this book of Josephus, Josephus is a first century Jewish historian. He does give us, I think, some more insight exactly what happened to this Solomon. He said, "But although Solomon was become the most glorious of kings, and the best beloved of God, and exceeded in wisdom and riches those that had been rulers of the Hebrews before him, yet did not he persevere in this happy state till he died. Nay, he forsook the observation of the laws of his father, and came to an end no way suitable for our foregoing history of him. He grew mad in his love for women, and laid no restraint on himself in his lust, nor was he satisfied with the women of his country alone. But he married many wives out of foreign nations, the Sidonese, the Tyrenese, the Ammonites, and the Edomites, and he transgressed the laws of Moses," because God said they were not to intermarry with the heathen. Now, God didn't care if you married somebody of a different race or a different country, but they had to be a convert to Judaism, right? Because I read in New York Times a while back where some fool had written an editorial saying that the Bible was a hate book because it condemned interracial marriage, so it's just a racist book. And that, to me, it just angered me, because it just shows the ignorance of people. People are so ignorant, and people are so gullible, and they don't know their Bible. God does not have anything against interracial marriage, but what he does have against is marrying somebody who is not a believer. And you see that in Old Testament, New Testament. Paul says, "Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers," because it's going to end up in disaster. All right, but Solomon, what he did is he married a lot of women that were not converted to Judaism. And this is what Josephus says about him. He goes on to say, "But Solomon was fallen headlong into unreasonable pleasures, and regarded not those admonitions. For when he had married 700 wives, the daughters of princesses and the eminent persons, and 300 concubines, and these besides the kings of Egypt's daughter, he soon was governed by them until he came to imitate their practices. He was forced to give them demonstrations of his kindness and affections to them, to live according to the laws of their countries. And as he grew in years, his reason became weaker by the length of time. It was not sufficient to recall to his mind the institutions of his country, so he still more and more contempted his own God and continued to regard the gods that his marriages has introduced. Josephus is difficult to read the way he words things, but basically he's saying this, is that Solomon ignored God's law when it came to intermarrying or marrying women or marrying somebody that was not a convert to Judaism, marrying somebody who was basically believed in other gods. And it's saying here, Josephus says that he became so driven by his lust, by his sexual appetites, that in order to placate his wives and to I guess please them or whatever, he would got involved with the worshiping of these other gods, these other deities. And here's the thing that, you know, I have said many times going through the Bible, is that if you look at the situation with the way it is with the way God designed men and women, I think it really, really says a lot. Because, first of all, in Deuteronomy 17, you know, God said don't multiply wives, and he disobeyed that. Also, in Deuteronomy 17:16, God said don't multiply horses, he did that. God gave this admonition to the kings that they were to write out his law and they were to read it every day. And apparently Solomon, because he disobeyed God on these various issues, you know, in spite of all his wisdom, he ends up being shipwrecked, and he ends up being shipwrecked because of women. But I really think it's very significant, because in my opinion, the most intelligent man that ever lived was Adam. And the reason I say that, and that's just speculative on my part, but I really believe that he probably was the most intelligent man that ever lived. His IQ is probably way off the charts. And the reason I say that is because he came directly from the hand of God. There was no flaw in him. And he was a walking encyclopedia. He could just look at any animal and just size them up in an instant and give them an appropriate name. I mean, what person can do that, right? He had to be the most intelligent man. But look what happened to him. His love for his wife, you know, clouded his reasoning. And we are told in Timothy that it wasn't Adam who was deceived, but the woman, being quite deceived, fell into transgression. So when Adam sinned, he sinned with his eyes open. All right, Eve was deceived. That's what we are told in Timothy, because I really believe that women have more of a tendency to filter things through their emotions. Now, that doesn't put women down at all. It's just simply saying there's a difference between male and female. I know that we're living in a culture today that's saying there's no difference whatsoever, but God is saying there's a vast difference between male and female, between men and women. And men, they got a real weakness when it comes to women. And you take the wisest, the smartest man that ever lived, in my opinion, the most intelligent man, he's brought down because of his love for a woman. You take the strongest man that ever lived, Samson. And look what happened to him. Look at the feats of this guy. He kills 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a jackass. You know, he runs down 300 foxes. Now, who can run down a fox? This guy, you know, he could do anything. He ran down these 300 foxes, ties all their tails together, put torches between their tails, and runs them through the standing grain of the Philistines. You know, he got so ticked off one night, he ripped up the gates of the Philistine cities, and they probably weighed around 2 tons. And he puts them on his back and runs all the way up to Mount Hebron, 20 miles away up the hill. And he throws them up on top of Mount Hebron. It's like, okay, come and get your gates, fools. I mean, this guy, his feats were just off the charts, off the charts. But no man could stand before this guy. But then he's brought down by a woman. All right, his lust for a woman. You take even Elijah. He's one of the greatest prophets that ever lived. He was afraid of no man. He stood up against 350 prophets of Baal single-handedly. He called down fire 3 times from heaven, twice to destroy pursuing armies. And, you know, he had one of the greatest victories recorded in the scriptures against God's enemies. And then the very next day, this crabby woman, Jezebel, puts a contract out on his life, and he goes running scared. He keeps running and running and running until he falls exhausted under a juniper tree and just begs God, just take my life. Just kill me. Man, I mean, what is it when you think about, you know, the power of a woman? Look at David. He's probably the greatest warrior that ever lived. He's a guy who loved God with all of his heart. He followed God all of his life. And what happens to him? He sees a woman taking a bath one night. He can't control himself. And then he ends up committing adultery. Then, to cover his tracks, when he found out that Bathsheba was pregnant, he brings home Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, from the battlefield. He's going to try to get Uriah to sleep with his wife so that nobody would know the difference between that this was actually David's kid. And anyway, long story short, Uriah doesn't go home to sleep with his wife. He just stays in the barracks or whatever because he doesn't feel right. He figures, well, all my buddies are out there sleeping in the cold ground in this battle. I can't go home to my wife. So anyway, that doesn't work. So the next day, David gets him drunk, thinking, well, I'll just lower his inhibitions and then, you know, he'll go home and sleep with his wife and nobody will be the wiser that this kid isn't his. Anyway, that didn't work either. So then David writes this letter that he seals and he gives it to Uriah. Say, give this to Joab, the commander-in-chief of David's army. And it basically said this, put Uriah on the front lines so that he can get killed. And so Uriah gets killed, plus several other people on this suicide mission. So you look at David and say, how did this happen? How does a man who loves God with all of his heart fall to the degree that he did, man? Not just in adultery, but now murder, and other people are killed, you know. And then it took basically Nathan the prophet to confront him about that, with that story about that ewe lamb. And then Nathan said, you're the man. And then David really, really repented. But see, God forgave him, but God judged him. He said that the sword will never depart from your house. And I know that I'm kind of rambling here, but if you look at what's happened here, say, how does this happen that these great men are brought so low by women? How does it happen? Look at Solomon. There hasn't been a man with this kind of wisdom, you know, to ever live before Solomon or after Solomon, except for Jesus Christ. And with all of his wisdom, he dies shipwrecked. And you got to ask, man, how does that happen with a guy with this kind of wisdom? You got to take everything in consideration. I really believe you got to take it in consideration when you were talking about Solomon. You're talking about his, basically how he became so, I think, totally shipwrecked in his relationship with God. And I think this is what happened. I really do. I usually go back to this Deuteronomy chapter 6 because this is what God says. And now remember, Solomon is he's not just the wisest man that ever lived, but Solomon is the richest man. He's the most wealthiest man. He's got everything at his fingertips when it comes to the amenities of this life. But this is what God said in Deuteronomy. He warned these people. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Now listen to this. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk to them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gate. You done? And on your gates. Then it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards, all trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied. And listen to this. Then watch yourselves, or beware that you do not forget the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. Now God is saying this. You get into this land here, and you get all this farmland, you get all these orchards, you get all these flocks and herds and cisterns and wells, and you get all this. And then you eat, and your bellies are full. He says, now beware. He says, because you're in a very, very dangerous position. Because when your bellies are full, God says, you're going to forget me. You're going to forget me unless you do one thing. I just read it here. Who is listening? What is the only antidote we have to not forgetting God when we're prosperous?
Being God's Word.
You got to read God's Word. You got to study God's Word. You got to meditate upon God's Word. You got to really, really study and reflect and meditate on God's Word on a daily basis. All right? This is what you got to do. Otherwise, we'll forget God. That's why Bible studies are so important. So many people today, they say, Bible study, forget. I got to watch this commercial. I got to, you know, it's just yawned. It can't be bothered with it. I'm saying, you know what? This is the only thing that's going to keep us standing in a nation where our bellies are full. You can hardly read the paper without it making some kind of reference to the fact that we are becoming a nation of people that are obese. I don't give a hoot if a person is 900 pounds. That's not my issue at all. My issue is this. We're well fed here. And that's our downfall, is when our bellies are full, we're going to forget God. We are becoming a nation that is just becoming obese, and we are forgetting God, all right? We're forgetting Him, because why? We're not reading His Word. We're not studying His Word. And I think that's exactly what happened to Solomon, because God told, you know, Moses to write down in the book, He says, when you get into your land and then you start having these kings, God said this, I want every king to sit down and write out a copy of the law. In other words, the first five books of Moses, he had to write it word for word, and they had to have a scribe standing over him, a priest, a Levite, and making sure that he did not omit one word, he didn't add anything, that he dotted every I, crossed every T, and then he had to have his own copy of basically the Bible. And God said he needs to study that every day, read that every day. Well, obviously that's not what Solomon did. He started out so well, and then he becomes so shipwrecked. So we were just reading here in Chronicles about how God raised up this Jeroboam. Now, I'm just going to read what happens here in this 1 Kings. If you want to turn to it, you can, but it's 1 Kings chapter 11, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's way too long. But I'm going to read about this Jeroboam, because in 1 Kings chapter 11, it talks about this guy, that because Solomon starts getting further and further away from God, God is raising up adversaries to deal with him. But this is what it says in 1 Kings chapter 11, starting with verse 26. Then Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the Ephraimite of Zerida, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. Now this was the reason why he rebelled against the king. Solomon built the Milo and closed up the breach of the city of his father David. Now the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. It came about at that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now Ahijah had clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him, and he tore it into 12 pieces. He said to Jeroboam, take for yourselves 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. But he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the city needs, Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the sons of Ammon, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight, and observing my statutes and my ordinances, as his father David did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life, for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, who observed my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom from his son's hand and give it to you, even 10 tribes. But to his son I will give one tribe, that my servant David may have a lamp always before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen for myself to put my name. I will take you, and you shall rule over whatever you desire, and you shall be king over Israel. Then it will be that if you listen to all that I command you, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, by observing my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you, and build you an enduring house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. Thus I will afflict descendants of David for this, but not always. Solomon sought therefore to put Jeroboam to death, but Jeroboam rose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and he was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Now, I'm trying to paint you this picture because you got to see what's happening here, because when we're going through the rest of Chronicles, unless we get this straight, I think it could get kind of confusing here. But this is what the prophet Ahijah did. When Jeroboam was in the field, Ahijah went up to him. He had a brand new cloak on. He takes it and rips it into 12 pieces. And he says, here, you take 10 pieces, all right? You're going to be ruling over 10 tribes of the northern tribes. And he's telling him this, I'm doing this because Solomon has forsaken me with all of his involvement with these foreign women and these foreign gods. And not only that, when you read what I just read here in 1 Kings, God is talking about, he's bringing a judgment on the nation because a lot of people are now getting into this idolatrous practices. So it's a judgment from God when this nation is going to be split. But he tells Jeroboam the same thing. He said, look, if you just obey me, just do what I tell you, just follow my laws, you know, and my statutes and my ordinances, then I'm going to secure your throne. But we are told in Josephus, I don't have time to read this whole thing, but in Josephus, he gives an account of what happened to this Jeroboam. He explains everything there, but then it goes on to say about Jeroboam, it says, so Jeroboam was elevated by these words of the prophet, and being a young man of warm temper and ambitious of greatness, he could not be quiet. And when he had so great a charge in the government and called to mind what had been revealed to him by Ahijah, he endeavored to persuade the people to forsake Solomon, to make a disturbance and to bring the government over to himself. But when Solomon understood his intention and treachery, he sought to catch him and to kill him. But Jeroboam was informed of it beforehand and fled to Shishak, the king of Egypt. And I'm just saying this. This gives us a little bit more detail of what happened here. The prophet Ahijah told Jeroboam, you're going to get the northern kingdom. But he's a young guy, and he's got a lot on the ball. He's a good leader. He's very, very industrious. And that's why Solomon put him in charge over his labor force. And he was a great warrior. But he just couldn't keep his mouth shut, according to Josephus. Instead, he wants to, I guess, accelerate this whole process of becoming king. So he's telling everybody, hey, God said I'm going to be king. And then he tries to stir up and foment a rebellion, a coup. And then Solomon gets word of it and puts a contract out on his life. So he flees to Egypt. But then once Solomon dies, the northern tribes send message down to Jeroboam where he's down there in Egypt. And he comes back. And that's where they have this meeting up here in Shechem. They have this meeting where with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. They have that meeting. And that's where Solomon's son simply says, well, let me back up. The people tell Solomon's son, look, we'll submit to you. Okay, we'll allow you to be our king and you will rule over us. But you better back off in terms of the way your dad ruled over us. Because the way he ruled over us, I mean, he was really, really a disciplinarian. And he really made our lives difficult with the way he treated us. And then that's when Solomon's son, Rehoboam, decided, you know what? Give me 3 days to think about this. And that's when he counseled, first of all of the older men in his administration, who were the advisors for Solomon. And they said, okay, do what the people say. All right, treat him kindly. Treat him with dignity. Treat him with respect. Don't threaten him. Don't be oppressive. All right, and then you will maintain your kingdom. But then, that's not good enough. So Rehoboam goes to all of his young advisors. He goes to all of his contemporaries, you know. And it's just a foregone conclusion. When you're young, you're dumb. All right? When you're young, you're dumb. I don't know of any exceptions. I was no exception. All right? That's just the way it is, man. You just lack that kind of understanding and wisdom and insight and experience. So these guys are really flexing their muscles. They say, oh, I tell you what. You just tell all these people. You think my dad was tough on you? He used whips on you. I'm going to use scorpions on you. You think my dad's thumb was heavy upon you? Man, wait till you see my thigh on you guys. I'm going to really do you a number. This is how stupid, how foolish, how ignorant that this guy was. And then the people said, what the hell would this? You, man. That's basically what they said. And they just took off and they made Jeroboam their king. Now, here's the thing. The reason I'm really trying to, maybe I'm beating this to death is, now you've got this kingdom that's split. You got the north and you got the south. You got Judah down here. And actually Simeon was basically assimilated into Judah. It just became one tribe. But Benjamin remained faithful to Judah. So then you've got these other northern tribes here, the other 10 tribes that now are being ruled in this northern kingdom. Now, here's what this Jeroboam does. He decides, you know what? God told these people through Moses that they had to go down. Every male was to go down who was 20 years old and up, had to go down 3 times a year to Jerusalem. There, they had to celebrate 3 different feasts. Okay, the first one, of course, was the Passover, all right, otherwise known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They had to go down every year to celebrate that, right? And then they had to go down and celebrate the Feast of Harvest, which is also known as Pentecost, all right? And then they had to also go down there and celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now, who could tell me what the Feast of Booths was? Okay, that was...
Good. Remind the people of there in the desert.
Yes, and that was celebrated basically in the seventh month of their calendar. They would go down there, and for a whole week, what they would do is they'd have to live in makeshift tents or huts or these shelters that they would make. And when they were down there, they had to live in these shelters. And it was God's way of trying to reinforce to every new generation what God did for them in the desert. Because when they're building these tents or these huts or these shelters, the little kids would say, "Why are we doing this, Daddy? Why are we doing that, Mommy?" And then they would explain, "Well, this is because we're going to commemorate. We're going to remember how God provided for our ancestors in the wilderness for 40 years. You know, they lived in these makeshift tents and these huts, and we're celebrating that. We're trying to remember that." Well, 3 times a year, God required his people to go down there. But now Jeroboam, he's up here in the north, and he says, "You know, I don't want these people going down there 3 times a year to worship at the temple the way God demanded and required." Now, who could tell me? I read in Josephus, and you can even read in the Bible here. But who could tell me what his reasoning was that he didn't want people to go down there? So he decided to set up 2 different temple sites up north.
Thought they might want to reunite eventually, get back together.
Exactly. That's exactly what Josephus says, and exactly what the Bible is telling us, is that Jeroboam was afraid. He was afraid. You know, if people start going down there 3 times a year to commemorate these feasts, eventually they may decide, you know what, we want to be one kingdom again, and then they're going to assassinate me. Right? Mm-hmm. That was his reasoning. So this is what he does. He decides, I'm going to set up an altar here in Bethel, and then I'm going to set an altar up here way up in Dan. So you got one in Dan and one over here in Bethel that's just basically outside of Judah. So here's this reasoning here. If these people, I'm going to make it convenient for them. Say, you don't have to go down to Jerusalem, especially if you live way up here. That's a 100-mile trek almost if you lived up in the north, right, to go down there 3 times a year. So he's saying to his people, look, you don't have to do that. Just go to Dan and worship there, or just go down to Bethel, whatever's most convenient for you, and worship there. This is what his whole reasoning is. Now, you tell me. Think hard. Think deep. Most of the people went along with that. Why?
Convenient.
It's convenient. Well, why should we go all the way down there? Why don't we just go where it's convenient? You see, this is where he gets all these people to sin. Now, I just want to read you what happened there when this Jeroboam, he ends up setting up these false deities. Actually, what he did is he fashioned 2 golden calves. He put one in Dan and one in Bethel. But it wasn't like it was a whole different god that was just manufactured out of thin air. He said that these golden calves actually represent the God of heaven, the same God who delivered us out of Egypt. Mm. Now, who else did that?
Aaron.
Yeah. Remember that? Here's a guy with no backbone whatsoever. You know, Moses is up on that mountain on Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. People say, where's this Moses guy, man? Whatever happened to him? He must have been struck dead up there. So they pressured Aaron into fashioning this golden calf. They gave him all their jewelry and their gold and stuff like that, and they melted it down, and he fashions this golden calf, and these people want to be led back to Egypt. And that's when Moses came down off that mountain where all these people were out of control, worshiping this golden calf and getting involved and getting drunk in this orgy. And Moses is absolutely livid, man. He's so angry. He takes the 10 commandments and throws them down on the ground and busts them all up. And when he's in this angry state, a lot of people quit carrying on. They quit all their shenanigans. But then there was a number of people in the camp who he couldn't get under control. And so he says, who's with me? And then all the Levites, the tribe of Levite, came to his side. Says, everyone, you get your sword on your side. You go through this camp here, this whole stinking camp, and you kill everyone who's out of control. I don't care if it's your mother, your brother, your sister, your best friend. You kill them. That's how he got this whole thing under control. And then he took that golden calf and he just pulverized it. It just pulverized it, smashed it into all this dust, and he threw it into this Kidron Lake or creek. And he told these people, get out there and drink that slop. Get out there and drink that, man. That's no God, you know. And when you're pissing it out of you, you'll know that's no God. That's my own paraphrase. But this is where he was so angry, right? Now, you would think that these people would look at what Jeroboam was doing and setting up these golden calves and say, hey, man, we're not having anything to do with that. But here's the problem with human nature, man, is that when we want to worship God in our own way, we're always going to end up in idolatry. We're always going to end up offending God. And how many people today are worshiping God in their own way? I mean, there's a lot in the church, right? But that's exactly what was foretold by Paul and Timothy, where he said that in the last days, he described how men are going to be like. He said that they're going to be lovers of money. They're going to be lovers of pleasure. They're going to be disobedient to parents. They're going to be arrogant. They're going to be... he just lists all these different 19 adjectives to describe. They're going to be reckless and conceited and boastful and all these things. But the very last thing that he said, he says, but they will be holding to a form of godliness, but denied the power therein. Now, what does that mean?
You're religious.
Yes.
Not really being hearing to God.
They would claim to believe in God. They would claim to be, quote unquote, spiritual, mm-hmm. but they would deny what God has said, mm-hmm. the power therein, right? And this is exactly what these people are doing here under just Jeroboam. Anyway, this is what it says. In 1 Kings chapter 12, it says this: then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of the Ephraim and lived there, and he went out from there and built Peniel. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. See, he's afraid that the people are going to go back down and want to be one nation again. So this is what it tells us in Kings. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then his heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, the king of Judah. So the king consulted, and he made two golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set one in Bethel and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made houses on high places. And anyway, he's talking about how he changed. Basically, he instituted a priesthood of people that weren't even Levites. And he changed the feast days as far as the dates were concerned. Now, this is what it says, or what happens when he sets up this golden calf. Because it goes on to say in 1 Kings chapter 13, now behold, there came a man from God from Judah to Bethel by the word of the Lord, while Jeroboam was standing by the altar to burn incense. He cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, altar, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a son will be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places and burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burnt on you. Then he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be split apart, and the ashes which are on it shall be poured out. And when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him. But his hand, which he stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. The altar also was split apart, and the ashes were poured out from the altar according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. The king said to the man of God, please entreat the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored to me. So the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and it became as it was before. Then the king said to the man of God, come home with me and refresh yourself, and I will give you your reward. But the man of God said to the king, if you were to give me half of your house, I would not go with you, nor would I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so it is commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, you shall eat no bread nor drink no water, nor return by the way which you came. So he went another way and did not return by the way which he came to Bethel. Now, I'm only sharing that because this is what's happened now when this kingdom is split. To consecrate this altar here, over here in Bethel, this king, he sets it up there. He's got a golden calf there. He's going to burn incense there. They got their own priest there. And then God sends a prophet from Judah up there to curse this altar in front of all of them. Now, this guy is an unknown prophet. We don't know what his name was. But he's from Judah, and God gave him very specific instructions, saying this: when you go up there, I don't want you to eat anything. I don't want you to drink anything. And you're not to return the same way, all right, that you went up there. Now, he gave him three commands, right? Now, if you look at basically the scale here, he didn't have very far to go. If he's from Judah, he may have had maybe 15 miles to go up to Bethel from where he was at, and especially if he's on a donkey or something. It wasn't too much, I think, of a burden that God put upon this man, but you think hard, think deep. Why would God tell him, don't drink anything, don't eat anything?
A couple of reasons, maybe. It's a very serious mission. Don't set your mind to it and just do that.
Yes.
And plus, you know, the land is defiled up there.
Yeah.
And also, it's a mechanism of fellowshipping.
Right.
Don't fellowship with them at
good.
All.
Very good. That's exactly it, man. This isn't a time for feasting. This is a time of mourning, man. You go up there, you fast. You don't eat. You don't drink. You go up there, you curse this altar, and you come back a different way. This is the commission that God gave this prophet, and he carries it out explicitly. He goes up there, and when this king is over by this altar, and they're offering this sacrifice, this guy comes out and says, "Oh, altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places, who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you." He says that right out in front of this guy, in front of the king, in front of his priest, in front of everybody. He yells this out, that this altar is going to be cursed. And he says, thus saith the Lord, there's going to be somebody born to the house of David, Josiah by name. Now, I don't know if anybody can remember this, but when did Josiah come upon the scene after this prediction, after this prophecy?
He was probably 100 years later, wasn't he?
It was 300 years later. Josiah is born and comes upon the scene, and God's mentioning him by name. There's going to be he says, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name. 300 years before he's born, God mentions him by name. You see, God can see it all right? And I don't want to get off on any tangent here either, because people really get fed up with me.
Is that a type of Christ by any chance?
No, but I'm just saying this, all right? God mentions him by name 300 years before he's born. And God does this with a number of people in the Bible. And my point is this, maybe it's a good thing they didn't have abortion clinics back then, right? God mentions him by name. So what does that say when it comes to, you know, us destroying all these unborn children? And I don't want to get off on a tangent there. I'm just simply saying, man, we should take this serious. God mentions this guy 300 years before he comes upon the scene. And when Josiah came upon the scene, he was one of the most godly men in all of Israel's history as far as the kings were concerned. And that's exactly what he did. He went up there and he took all these bones of these priests that were offering up sacrifices on his altar, and he had them burned on the altar. He dug them up or took them out of their graves and burned them. And he also said this in this 1 Kings chapter 13. He says, then he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be split apart, and the ashes which are on it shall be poured out. Now when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which we cried against the altar of Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him. But his hand which he stretched out against him dried up, so that he could not draw it back to himself. The altar also split apart, and the ashes were poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. My point is this. You get this picture? This guy is doing something that's totally against God's will. And he's motivated by the fact that, you know what, I don't want to lose my position. I don't want to lose my fame. I don't want to lose my power. I don't want to lose my prestige. And if people go down there and start worshiping the way they're supposed to be worshiping, they may turn on me someday. But God had told him specifically, look, all you need to do is obey me and I'll establish your throne. But look at what people do today who get in power. They will say anything. They will do anything to keep their 15 minutes of fame or their perks. All these phonies that get in office nowadays, hardly any of them are worth a hoot, because the first thing they do when they get into office is they just try to raise money to get reelected. They don't do anything of any substance whatsoever for the good of this country. And I'm just simply saying here, you can see a situation where this king, he was more concerned about his position and his authority and his power than he was in terms of obeying God. But the irony is, if he only obeyed God, he would establish his throne up there, right? This is what these people just don't get, man. The people that are running this country into the ground, they just don't see it. Just like with this guy here, didn't see it. But then what happens there? His arm shrivels up. And now he's really under conviction. And now he says to the prophet, oh, pray to God that he'll restore my arm. And he restores it, right? So this guy knows this guy is speaking for God. This guy's a prophet. But now this Jeroboam says to this prophet, he says, hey, come home with me. Come home and have lunch with me, man. We'll eat and we'll have some fellowship. And then the unknown prophet says, no, can't do that. Can't do that. God said, I'm not eating anything here, drink anything. I'm supposed to go back a different way. Because let's just say that he did go and have a meal, have lunch with Jeroboam. That would have sent such a conflicting message. Why?
Yeah, it's like God's condoning me because look, the prophet came and they came home with me, and I must be, you know.
In other words, right. This was a real conviction, not just to the king, but to everybody who witnessed this, that God's cursing this altar. But now, if this prophet goes home with Jeroboam to have lunch, it's almost like, well, things aren't that bad. I mean, we can just agree to disagree, you know, tomato, tomato, potato, potato. I mean, it's just all, you know, however. And you see what I'm saying? But God just said, no, you're not to eat or drink any. Make a beeline back, right? Because he put this curse on it. But then, I'm not going to read the whole rest of the story because it's way too long. But then what happened there is now the prophet's been obedient to this point. And then he gets on his donkey, starts heading back to Judah, starts heading back home. And then there are two guys that witness this whole thing as far as the altar being cursed and the king's arm shriveling up and everything that's happened. They ran home and told their dad, who was an old prophet of God, that God used him as a prophet. And they told their dad everything that happened. And their dad said, well, which way did he go? And he said, well, he went down that way. So this old man saddles up his donkey, goes tearing off down the road to find this prophet. And he finds this prophet sitting under an oak tree. All right, just relaxing, kicking back. And this prophet comes up to him, this old prophet, and says, are you the guy that cursed this altar at Bethel? He says, yeah. He says, well, come home with me, man. Come home with me, and we'll have fellowship together. We'll have a meal together, and we can talk about war stories or whatever. And the prophet said, no, I can't do that. He says, God said, I'm not going to eat or drink anything. Then this old prophet, because he wanted to have fellowship with this guy so much, he lies to him. He lies to him and says, hey, look. An angel appeared to me and said that you're to come home with me and have lunch. See? And then that unnamed prophet fell for it. Because I'm sure he really wanted to. He figured, well, it'd be great, man. I get a free meal and then I could talk over what happened there. It'd be great. I'll have some fellowship. And you know what I'm saying? It was a real temptation. But he says, okay, well, if God changed his mind, I'll go on with you. Well, what happened to that guy? Anybody remember?
Lion.
Yeah, right in the middle of having this meal, the old prophet, Spirit of God comes upon him, and he just gets into that unnamed prophet's face, and he says, hey, man, you didn't obey me. You're going to be killed by a lion on the way home. And sure enough, he was. He left, and on his way, he was attacked by a lion. But interesting thing, the lion attacked this prophet, and he killed him. But then, when the old man heard that he was killed by a lion, the old man goes out to find him. He finds the donkey there, he finds the lion there, and he finds the dead prophet on the road. Now, the dead prophet wasn't devoured by the lion, but what's so unusual about that arrangement there? Well, if you were that donkey and you had a lion standing next to you, what would you have done? I mean, the whole thing is orchestrated by God, right?
Yeah. So the young man, the prophet that wanted to obey God, didn't, and so he ends up dead.
Yes, and you know, I know that I've really taken a long time to just kind of paint this picture of what has happened here, all right? Because I want people to understand what's going on in regards to this whole splitting of this kingdom. And that's why I've taken so long to try to explain everything that's happened, because now we're going to be going through king after king after king after king, one in the south, one in the north, one in the south, one in the north, and you're going to have your brain scrambled unless you can understand how this all came about. Is it was a judgment from God. This whole thing was just split. And it also happened with the church. How did that happen? Come on, you guys. Where are you? There it is. Here's the thing. I know that, you know, the Catholics are really lambasted to no end by a lot of Protestants, you know, who do this. But I would say this. You got to look at church history. And believe me, you just can't take 1,500 years of church history and cut it off at the knees and say, well, the church didn't begin until the reformers, until Martin Luther came along with all the reformers. Reformers, no, you have to look at it. That's exactly what happened to the church. You know, what you got here is 1,500 years of church history, and then you've seen all the corruption in the church. You've seen all of these worthless leaders in the church. These people were selling indulgences, and they were doing all kinds of different things to offend God. And then God just brought a judgment on the church, and the church split. But keep this in mind. People in the south, in southern Judah, right, and the people in the north, God still looked at them as being his people. Mm-hmm. So I don't care what denomination you belong to, as long as it's not a cult, right? If you have the basics, and what I mean the basics, you have the fundamentals. You believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. That's paramount. The Jehovah Witnesses deny that. They're a cult, all right? You believe in his virgin birth. You believe in his atoning death on that cross, all right? You believe in his resurrection. You believe in repentance. You believe in judgment. You believe in hell. You believe in his return. All you have to do is just believe about seven or eight things. If your church teaches those things, guess what? You're part of God's people. I don't care whether you're Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, whether you're Catholic, whether you're Protestant, whether you're Evangelical, whether you're Pentecostal. Let's go down the line, right? But look at how it's all fragmented today. It's because of sin in the church. That's what happened. The same thing that happened to Israel, God's people, has happened to the church. It's almost like you see history repeat itself, don't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you see.
It's fragmented outwardly, but the true church is still unified.
Well, the true church is what? The true church is the body of Christ.
Right.
The truth. I don't care what denomination you are. The true church is a body. And believe me, when Jesus Christ comes back and sets up his kingdom, there's not going to be all of these different denominations as far as the church. And Israel itself is going to be one. They're not a divided nation today, but under Jesus Christ, they will be a whole nation again. Now, anybody have anything to add or share? I'm sorry I took so long with this, but I'm telling you, you've got to get this straight in your mind, because otherwise I think you're going to get kind of confused when we're going through the rest of this Chronicles.